Tony Johnson event. He wasn't able to make it last year, but fortunately we do have him here. I don't think you need much background on him. I'll just mention that his career is reflected as him being named to the writer's wing of the Hall of Fame. He has, he became sports editor of the Washington Post in 1925 or 26, 1926. He was 12 years old at the time. So I don't think I'll take up any more of your time. Now, I'm sorry about the no mic, but one thing I did want him to, and I've been after him for the last couple of years on this, was to talk about some of those old-time sports writers. Just tremendous names there that we can't recall, but must have been quite interesting. And Damon Runyon was one, Paul Gallico, Robert Rourke, Bob Considine, Haywood Bruin, Westbrook Pegler. I have to stop with Westbrook Pegler because I was at the University of Missouri Journalism School in 1948, and we have a journalism week there each year. That particular year, Westbrook Pegler was asked to come out. And Frank Luther Mott was the dean of the school, and he introduced him, and he came right out and said, "I don't agree with the way you feel about things. I don't agree with the way you write and so forth, but we think that you ought to have an opportunity to talk to us." And Pegler just sat there smiling all the way through that introduction, and then he went on from there. But in my mind, Westbrook Pegler was kind of a print version of Morton Downey Jr. Okay, that's your introduction.
I have these notes telling me what Todd Davis told me to talk about. Just as he said, it was old-time sports writers of any generation. I hope you can hear me.
Yes, you'll have to just... Who was that opera singer who used to belt it out? Helen Traubel or something like that?
No, Helen Merman.
Okay.
You know, I'm here in any one of many roles. I could be here as an old sports writer.
Yes.
As a current sports writer, you know, old columnist, member of the League of American Penguins. They sent me a card. Or even a member of Who's Who in American Women. You find me in the 1960s.
Yeah, I have to interrupt at that point. My wife and I were watching his son, son Maury's program, Current Affair, and on the, you were probably, I didn't call you at that time because I figured you'd be watching it. Anyway, Maury made the remark that they would come up to him and say, "And is your mother's name George?" I don't know if there's anything to that or not.
Well, I have some memories of Maury not fond. But this was back during the war years when I saw them at breakfast, which was a rare sight for me because I wasn't down that early. And there he is, and he's bundled up a lot of old newspapers. And I said, "What's going on here? What are these papers?" He said, "Daddy said, we take these old papers to school and we sell them." And he says, "We give the money to charity." And he says, "We get 65 cents 100 pounds for that stuff you write in the Post." And here I'm taking out of my typewriter sheet by sheet, and that little bum is measuring by the hundredweight. So all of my memories of Maury are not fun. And I must say, I enjoyed the recitation by a previous speaker who told him that the pre-radio, pre-television World Series, how good it was and how well I remember. I was part of that. I saw those magnetic balls going all over that board. And when I had my little crystal set, listening to the final game before the last game of the 1924 World Series, and hooray, I could get it on a crystal set. I heard the Senators win the pennant. And that was the day before the season ended, I think, because the next day in a meaningless game, they put Nick Altrock up to hit. And he got his hit and led the league with 1,000 batting average. And I remember hearing this so very well. So that was my life, and I must say, Bob Davis didn't have to urge me much to ask me to come over here and talk to you. I'm just delighted to be with baseball people, because that too has been my life. It began my life from a very early age. And when you talked about the World Series, before radio, before television, I can tell you about the World Series. And I think the year was about 1918, 17. In Bar Harbor, Maine, on Western Union, they put up score by innings. That was all. I think I remember one of the pictures, Joe Wood. But my interest in baseball began somewhere around that time when I was about 11 or 12 years old, and a baseball fan, and I read the Boston papers and all of the names, and to find out how the Red Sox came out. They were my team. So it was no Sunday baseball then, but they would play on Tuesday, and how did the Red Sox make it? Tuesday afternoon, no night games, Tuesday afternoon. What was the score? I found out Wednesday evening when the Boston boat came in at 6 o'clock, Wednesday night. I brought the papers to see how the game came out Tuesday afternoon. And I had my choice. I bought the Boston Post, the Boston Globe, the Boston Herald, the Boston American, the Boston Transcript. All for 2 cents apiece. But pretty soon, I realized that was too expensive. I had to narrow it down and get the paper I liked. I settled on the Boston Post. And I can tell you it wasn't because I had any talent for judging the quality of writing. I couldn't. All I knew was that the Boston Post had an extra baseball story and all the other papers didn't. And that was my meat, the extra baseball story, written by Paul Shannon. As I said, I tell you about the quality of the writing, which I was unable to judge. I'll take you to 1930 in the Copley Plaza Hotel, Walter Johnson managing the Senators. This day before the game, and we're talking to Walter Johnson in the lobby, Bob Considine and myself, and Johnson says, "Boys, it was 10 years ago today. In this very town, I pitched my only no-hit game." And this was fascinating. Bob and I went straight across the Catty Corner Square and looked at the Boston Library, saw the story of Walter Johnson's no-hit game. Wonderful story. You talk about provincialism. Story began. Harry Harper held the Senators to 2 hits today and was beaten 1-0 when Bucky Harris scratched the hit off the glove of Everett Scott. For the Senators, Walter Johnson pitched a no-hit game. But I must say, we were talking about baseball writers. Let us talk about baseball writers. Those are the people I know. I grew up had no idea that I would ever be one. I had no idea I'd ever see a baseball game. I dreamed. Boy and Bob, dreaming someday I might see a baseball, a big league game. On my way to Washington, I got off the train in New York, and people were talking about the World Series, 1922, Giants and Yankees, Polo Grounds, and some people were going up there, and I asked if I could go with them. They said, yes, they were going to get bleacher seats for $2. And not knowing you could check a suitcase, I dragged it all the way with me. We got to the Polo Grounds and all the bleacher seats are sold out. What do you do now? So one chap suggested we go over to Coogan's Bluff. I dragged that suitcase all the way. See the game from there. I saw it. My first major league game, Coogan's Bluff. I saw are the pitcher, the catcher, third baseman, shortstop, and left fielder. All guys, my first game. Sometimes the center fielder might come over there. Left fielder. But I was happy. I was happy to see one half a major league game, never dreaming, and I say this with some allowance for being mistaken, but maybe when I go into a baseball park now, maybe I've seen more big league games than any of the other 60,000 people in the park. I didn't plan it that way, but I must say it evolved beautifully for me on the baseball fan, and being a baseball writer was the best of all worlds, I can tell you. You asked me to talk about other baseball writers. Well, they were a different breed back there when I broke in. They were not the so-called adversary writers. Now, there's so many baseball writers, the players are their enemies. We traveled on the trains, we got to know each other. The ball players, we were more intimate with them, we had to like them and all that. So we weren't necessarily out to kill them, as so many of them right now in such an accusative way. But I'm not saying they're better baseball writers than we were. I really believe that there are more good baseball writers than we were. Maybe that's because they're more writers. Now, three men cover a team, coming, going, and one covers a dugout, one covers a locker room, dressing room, one covers a game. I used to cover the Senators, write seven game stories a week and six columns in addition every week. But more good baseball writers, but where are the Giants? Where are the really bright ones? Where are the great lights of our profession? As Bud Davis says, where is Westbrook Pegna, Paul Gallico, Heywood Bruce, Grant Rice, Vincent Flair, and Bob Considine, my old friend Bob Rourke. I like to see their equals, and I haven't seen, I should have mentioned Red Smith.
Yeah.
First, I should have mentioned my friend Red Smith. Fine writers. Giants, no. Tom Boswell, great. Where are the others? You know. But baseball has become a different game for me. I was appalled to learn a few years ago that baseball writers in Washington, New York, Chicago, California, they have a network. They have a network. What are you going to write today? These bums go out there and have a conference call and say, what do you know? I mean, we were on our own wondering what the hell we're going to write about. With network. And you see the same stuff all over the country. They swap stories. Possibly it isn't a bad thing. It's very informative for the fans, but I'm not so certain that as an endeavor it can be applauded. But that's the new breed in baseball writing. And I used to cover the World Series all by myself. Washington Post sends eight men to have the same games I covered. Possibly they cover them better, I'm not sure about that. And certainly they cover it in more volume, but I'm not sure volume means quality. But it's giving the fans apparently what they want, which is more, and they're always hungry for more, and I suppose these are the times. Boy, we talked about Westbrook Pegna. Westbrook Pegna, they alluded to the fact, Westbrook Pegna may not have liked anybody. Well, it may or may not be true. He liked me. I was his friend and roommate. He taught me a great deal. He was one of the finest writers who ever lived. He taught me that, for example, not to love the club owners. He did. He taught me not to go to the club owners' press rooms and parties and drink up their whiskey and eat all their food. He said, let's not be beholden to these bastards. I thank heaven I learned this. I'm not blaming those who were, but we had our own preferences and our own stuff.
Westbrook Pegler taught me another thing. He taught me it's no sin to sit down to your typewriter and bat out a story, and if you didn't like the first paragraph, leave and give another. He tore that out of your paper. Westbrook Pegler could take out 8 different leads, roll them up in his, roll the paper up his hand, and aim at the wastebasket and hit it every time. Throwing away leads in the sentence, he read it, this dog don't hunt, I won't use it. And he goes with another one. It's no shame and no disgrace to rewrite yourself. And it's better if you don't have to, but it's not assumed. Westbrook Pegler, one of the great ones, Grantland Rice, everybody's lovable guy, had poetry along with his writing. Sometimes you wonder, and Grantland Rice wrote the great football lead about four horsemen of the apocalypse, Notre Dame's great team, and it was so flowery and against the gray October sky, and we rather believe he couldn't get it in the paper then. It was such corn. But nevertheless, in his own style, he could write so well. And Heywood Broun, great. He wrote the famous line when he was a baseball writer for a short time. Ruth struck out 3 times, came up in the 10th, hit one with 3 on, and his famous line. Ruth crushed to earth will rise again. This is Heywood Broun at his best. And Fred Leib, one of the great baseball writers. And he was probably better informed than everybody else. Rose kept writing into a long distant age, even older than I am at this point. But there was an episode here in the Baseball Writers Association in which Fred Leib enjoyed the distinction of gold card, baseball writer's card number 1, which I now hold. But after all these years of Fred Leib, number 1 in the Baseball Writers, a chap from Cleveland, whose name I'm trying to recall, began to complain that he antedated Fred Leib, that he was a certified baseball writer for the Cleveland Press, all the blame dealer, all these years. And he was entitled to number 1. Well, we looked him up at the committee. He's right, not Fred Leib. What do you do to Fred Leib? Solomon liked the situation. Without the knowledge of either one, we issued 2 number 1. But the Cleveland baseball fans, they never breed all their own. I am not good friends with Cleveland baseball writers, but Cleveland baseball writers had a reputation for second-guessing the manager. You know, this and that, they got managers fired and all this sort of thing. It's not fair that one of the writers named Ed Bang insisted that the manager show him the lineup before the game began. But nevertheless, this was a reputation Cleveland baseball writers had, and then they deserved it. But I'd like to speak of my friend Gordon Coverick of the Cleveland Clay Beaver. Good friend, fine friend. So now what happens? We wind up overseas together now with war correspondents in the South Pacific. I'm there on Guam between operations between Iwo and Okinawa. And I'm bunking with an old Philadelphia Fullerton baseball writer named Don Donaghy. Don Donaghy, fine writer, humorous, paragraph writer. Don Donaghy, to me, is one of the most interesting people I've ever known. From Guam, he knew where all the whiskey was at all the time, and where it could be obtained. And he would wake up with a hangover here and there, and on the way to Pacific, he went out there on the brand new battleship Missouri, which was an event. Eventually landed Pacific. And he was showing me some of the stuff he'd written about when Missouri, battleship Missouri, got to Honolulu on its way out to the Pacific. Now you've got a 12-hour layover, and Don Radigay lands in a couple of bistros here and there, and he goes back to the Blewett. The battleship Missouri took off without him. And now he's writing the stuff for his paper. First correspondent in the history of World War II who ever misplaced a 45,000-ton cannon. Great, great humorous. We had good humorous. So now, Donaghy's on Guam, I'm on Guam, they're bunking together, I'm at headquarters at this point, and Nimitz's headquarters, and who comes in but Kovalnik, Gordon Kovalnik. I'm happy to see him, he's a new man, and I can show him how to cut all the red tape, get all his credentials, and maybe get a bunk to stay. And we're fine. And he thanked me, and I go back to my bunk, and there's Donaghy, he is still asleep, still on over. And I try to shake him, wake him up, it's impossible. I finally said, wait a minute, Don, try to think. Just who got in? I says, another sports writer turned war correspondent. He showed a little bit of interest. And he turned over and he said, who that? I said, Kovalnik from Cleveland. He says, gee, right? That's the end of Nimitz. We have sports writers with in that respect, we had my friend from the United Press, Henry McElmore, one of the fine writers, be a great writer in any age, writing everything in the United Press. Now we're covering the 1934 World Series, St. Cardinals and Tigers, I think it's 34. Mm-hmm. This is a series of a Dizzy D and How Am I Doing, Edna?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Where he claimed he shook hands and yelled at him that they had a pitching hand. Lots of things happened in Virginia, including the poker game. We always have the poker game on the train and we have private cars. And from St. Louis, we're going to Detroit with the third game of the World Series, and everybody was a poker game. And McElmore's in there, and I must say he's a lousy poker player. And he can never write a business when it came without a shot. And the country enemy took him for everything he had. He arrived in Detroit, so that was all he could talk about. He said he lost his expense money. There was $85. That was enough to take me through the World Series. And so we had to hustle it. Little sleep. Next day, game begins at 1:00. We didn't get into Detroit until about 5:00 a.m. I'd get up quick, go to the game, cover the game, go back to the hotel, book Cadillac. There is Henry McElmore. He says, hey, help. He says, I blew it. I missed the game. All of a sudden, tell me what happened.
Don't tell me no problem.
And so I said, well, come on, let's go to the press room. And I said, and I started telling him. Wait a minute. I got another idea. I said, what's that? He said, wait. Stick around. So we went over to the typewriter. We're going there for about half an hour. Bang, bang. He says, how do you like this? Think I can get away with this? I said, this guy, he has relieved himself of all detail in the game. Third World Series game is seen from the Goodyear blimp. He's on the whole scene. Lovely, and he's a good rider and everything, and I said, great, go with it. Can't miss. He said, wait. And he looked at me and said, another picture. Then he says, blimp hire, $85. these are people. These are people. It was so much fun. We were. We weren't beholden to anybody. We weren't angry with people. We tried to We try to be good, and we try to be accurate, and we try to be friendly. I tried to be friendly one day, many years ago, when Bucky Harris had one of his 3 or 4 terms as manager of the Senators, with friends. And Griffith always hired him, Griffith liked him, there's good faith in him, but they lost 6 in a row. And poor Mr. Griffith, sitting back in his office, listening them to lose one more game by one run again. Did they bunt or should they have bunted? And Bucky can't do anything right. Only one run that didn't bunt. And even though Mr. Griffith was fond of Harris, he could get ideas how to save his Harris job. But it was at this of the year when the Senators game used to be broadcast by Arch McDonald. And he would recreate them, or you said the Western Union operators, strike one, strike two, fly to center, right. And these were the days when we didn't get anything for the radio contractor. But Mr. Griffith gave them away to People's Drugstore. People's Drugstore would simply pick up the Western Union charge of $20 or $30 a day, pay the operator, and this was, Mr. Griffith got no revenue. But at this point, some brain at the Washington Post says, why don't the Washington Post sponsor this thing? He says, oh, we did. And he says, as long as we're there, Shelley, instead of letting the operator do it, why can't you help him? So I'm sitting with the operator in Cleveland, and I want to give Arch McDonald something more to say than fly to center field. Every ball hit the center or left is a spectacular catch, you know. And he goes way back into the corner, throws those 5 balls. Part of his right chest beat something. Always done. So now we're in Cleveland, can't win, losing again, 1 run behind, top of the ninth. Glory be, we got 2 on, Buddy Lewis got on somehow. Nobody else. Need a run. Build a spot, you lay one down there. Bad lay one out there, it's time and winning run, second, third, over the other. See if some Travis comes up. Great at it. So here's the first pitch. Big ripple. Strike one, what a swing he took. That operator's fault. He says, take this. Travis missed an attempt to bunt. Now I'm thinking of Mr. Griffith back here. Okay? I was trying to save Puppy's job. So I'm in nobody's harm. It's a lie, it's a white lie, but in a good moment. So maybe it wasn't a fair. So here comes the next pitch. Paul. Travis fouled off a second attempt. Good, lying in my teeth. And hurting nobody. Nobody knew the difference, just between the offer and myself. But glory be, next pitch, Harris knew what he was doing. Travis tripled. Travis had just gone to hit. Travis, Lucky knew that. Another thing, we should remember, baseball players don't know everything. We should remember, Travis was a lousy bunter. Harris knew it. Now, this is unlike the Cecil Travis that I saw come up to play his first game in Chattanooga. And here he is, this tall, not big, looking guy who says, plays third base, comes to bat. Over the third baseman's head. What a lucky day. That day, he got 5 lucky hits. 5 for 5. All over the third base. It's in the book. And you know, what a great hitter. I thought a couple of years he was the best shortstop in played third base, later shortstop, best shortstop possibly in that sort. But he had bad luck. How would you like that 356 and lose the Patton championship by 50 points? Finish second. And that's what happened to Tiffle Travis and Ted Williams' big year. When we go baseball, I think, we had all kind of characters as baseball players. Harry Grayson, my friend in Cleveland, and also in Cleveland, both for the NEA and Newspaper Enterprise Service, everybody was always with us. Wonderful. So we wind up, Harry didn't bother about interviewing players or manager. He interviewed his friends, the other baseball writers, who would tell him more about what was happening and talk to the manager friends. Yes, right. And so I was with him, helping him write a couple of columns one night. And we wound up in Hotel Cleveland. There we closed the bar. And Harry said, I guess I better be going. I said, wait a minute. He said, I got to be to work in the morning. I said, wait a minute. I had a lovely place upstairs, two big beds in there, the office is up the street, where to spend the night. Upon Harry says, well, no, surely that's heavy here. I haven't been home, he says, in 3 months. He says, better go home and build up a little character. These are the types. These are the types that we knew and liked and counted as friends, kinds of types. So I think one of our types named Chili Doyle in Pittsburgh, he, an old-time baseball writer, I think he invented a phrase, and it's claimed that he did, and I'm going to give him the credit, because he saw a bad play in Philadelphia, and a horrible boner, and strategic, or whatever it was, and that's when he uttered the word, because Connie Mack were alive, he'd roll over in his grave, and it came right from Chili Doyle. We had a wonderfully interesting guy, fascinating man, a good writer, not a great history. He fascinated me for a couple of reasons. He called out the late Dan Daniel, wrote for years for the New York World. And he attributed to himself as being the greatest authority on baseball who ever lived. I hate to say it, at this time he was a perfect ass. And his pomposity was well known. And consequently, he counted himself on the inside with the management. He claims credit for ending Babe Ruth's holdout. I took Babe Ruth there, and I got him and Rupert together, and he was responsible for everything. But meanwhile, younger and better reporters were saying, they were scooping him right and left. They got all the breaking stories, and he was in an afternoon paper, going left behind, and was always late with all the breaking stories, and then one famous line that was repeated day after day. But say, for example, the three-player deal swung between the Yankees and Cleveland Indians yesterday came as no surprise to this correspondent. He has been beaten 40 ways on it. He's looking out the window. He had nothing about it in his own paper. Second day, he tried to read him. Everything comes as no surprise to Dan Daniel. We had another New Yorker writer, and maybe not as famous, but a better writer than most of them, was Harold Rosenbaum, the old New York Herald Tribune, the one that spawned Roger Kahn, Red Smith, and I would say that it was an incubator for more good baseball writers than any other publication. You know, Harold Rosenbaum. Fine writer. And we like to talk baseball. We got together always on the trains to the river and hotel bars. And he says, one day, he says, guys, let me tell you something. He says, I'm waiting.
He says,
to write the perfect lead perfect case. And I want it to happen that way. For example, when it happens, two pitchers, Smith Jones, pitched a double no-hitter today. Nobody got on base. Everybody struck out. It was a dog. It is Errol Rosenthal, at his very best. Well, it was, I'm going to tell you, it was a joy. It was a joy to live in those times. And I, young baseball writer, smart ass writer, I guess. I talked to umpires, talked to anybody I heard baseball over here. For example, I talked to Tommy Connolly, who was willing to talk, but he was a dean of all baseball, of all umpires at that time, and a very feisty little Irishman. So I would invent all kinds of questions. Tommy Connolly, when this question, I said, what happens, Tom? Suppose in a double play situation, the ball is hit for short, he throws to the first, and he throws to the second baseman, and at this point, the second baseman drops dead. I got the answer to this. Tommy says, well, Sonny boy, he says, I'll tell you. When it happens, I'll call it. Billy Evans once explained to me something that I thought was the most interesting aspect of the company. Why do you think I'm on first base in my arms? I said, tell me. I'm doing myself a favor, he says. Nothing premature, Shirley, he says. I'm not too quick to call the play because it gives me an extra second to unfold my arms. And that's what he wanted. He wanted buying time before out safe, making the wrong call. He bought time by folding his arms. No umpire ever did it before he did, and everybody does it since. So you have a bit of history here. I want to throw one up to you. This was a story told to me by Billy Evans many years ago. And I have been so fascinated by this. You're telling me about calls and plays and decisions. And he says, I'd like to tell you about the game in Washington at Griffin Stadium. He says, in which Eddie A. Smith, the catcher, steals home from third, but he doesn't steal home. He says he's on third base, two out, two strikes on the hitter. Chief Bender is pitching. Bender is very proud. Nobody ever stole home on Bender in their life. Clark Griffith is the manager. Not the owner, could be 1912. Ainsworth and Bender, two out, whoever's in there, who's got it. And Ainsworth fakes it, going home from third. Fakes it. This time he ain't faking it all the way. Bender's still winding up. There was no throw. Ainsworth slides in, virtually back in the dugout, dusting himself off. Bender comes in with a pitch, fly to center field, and Billy Evans says, now I have to tell Clark Griffith, Ainsworth's run don't count. Ainsworth has a stone. And Griffith is raising hell. He says, I pulled the rule book on him. embarrass us. And Benda was smart enough to know that if he can get that batter out on the next pitch, technically the side is retired because Evans says it's the umpire's duty is to call the next, give the decision on the pitch before I give the decision on any other happenings on the field. And Benda knew it, and I knew it. His pitch starts with the windup. And as long as Benda kept winding up, that's the pitch. And that's the decision the Steel must wait on. And if they're 8-2 out, he flies to center field, the run counts. And if it's a walk, the run counts. If Benda knew, get the guy up, and the stupid batter will have this, could lead off the pitch. Well, I wondered about the truth of this. And you may look it up for yourself. You can make a project out of it if you want to. But I was telling Ted Williams about this as we were traveling on a train to an All-Star game from Boston to St. Louis one time, for a long time, and Ted and I talked baseball a great deal, and I said to Ted, I'm telling him the story. And he was truly excited about it. He didn't question the truth. What his reaction was, typically Williams, what the reaction is. He says, Jesus Christ, he says, and if I'm the guy who stole home, he says, I got to get my ass back on third base and touch home plate on the way if there's less than two outs. So this is his reaction. He didn't question the accuracy. So there it is. I leave it with you, and I'm gonna leave you actually in a couple of minutes. You know, I was in the generation age when we were sports writers became ghost writers. Ghost writers was not a dishonest profession, and as Ben Chapman looked up. The writers in Cleveland one time when they didn't give him a hit on the ball that somebody fumbled and then picked up the harvest of red crop and said, you lousy so-and-so $40 a week sports writers. That's what he was. So to make a living, I guess some of you had to do ghostwriting. I got my introduction to ghostwriting in the 1924 World Series when I was a young Cub reporter. Sitting in the press box, and the seat next to me, his name was Babe Ruth. I was here, Babe Ruth here. Except Babe Ruth isn't there. His ghostwriter was Christy Walsh, who was his agent. And so, about the second interval, Christy Walsh breezed in the press box. She looked around, saw the empty seat, asked everybody where's Ruth. So we told him, I said, well, Ruth this morning went to emergency hospital. He has an appendicitis, emergency appendicitis. And he says, went to the hospital. He says, what's the hospital? I said, the hospital. He says, oh. But before he did anything else, he said, get me an operator. So they brought him the telegraph operator, and he sat down, the operator there, and Christy Walsh says, take this, by Babe Ruth, Washington, D.C., October 5th. As I sit here, lay here in emergency hospital in Washington, D.C., even as a native New Yorker, my sentiments are with the Americans. Went on from there. This is my introduction to it. We're talking all about ghostwriting. I began to do ghostwriting myself for the Washington Post. I ghost. In 1925, the Post hired some ghostwriters to do stuff for Gosling, Drew, Harris, everybody in the Pittsburgh World Series. And in Pittsburgh, Judge Landis, commissioner, called Sam Rice in and say, what's going on here? You're going to be expelled from the series if you continue to second-guess the umpire. Sam Rice is being called on the carpet. He hasn't seen what he wrote. Never knew what he wrote. But this was the ghostwriting age, and I've told this story before. We were on one train, and we had the usual poker game, and everybody was going to get the poker game together, and Christy Walsh had all these ghostwriters in his stable, and one guy named Joe somebody, and we're getting the game together, and somebody's, this writer says, hey, save me a seat, save me a seat. I won't be long in this. And all I got is Trish Bottomley and Gary Left. And so when you talked the other day about the Radio Days World Series, and this was the beginning of Radio. Graham McNamee made himself famous, of course, I'm memory. You're doing the All-Star Games, Chicago, 1933. I'm not there. The post is too poor to send it. The post made a sensation around the world. And here, I forget the end. American League is back. And here it is.